Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, I'm Alejandra Bronfman, and this is New Books in Caribbean Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. If you like this podcast, please download, like, tweet, retweet, and all that good stuff. It's really much appreciated by all of us. My guest today is Megan Raby. She's the author of American Tropics, Caribbean Roots of Biodiversity Science, published by UNC Press in 2017. This book takes us to biological research stations in Costa Rica, Panama, Cuba, and Guyana, where U.S. scientists conducted research on local species and through which the concepts of biodiversity emerged. Raby argues that these concepts must be understood as connected to imperial practices, including the exclusion of local scientists and forced relocations in order to produce wilderness. This is a fascinating story and a timely intervention in debates about the production of knowledge. Here's our conversation. Hi, Megan. Thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thanks. I'm a big fan of the New Books Network, so it's really a pleasure to be here.
Great. So, let's just jump in. This is a book about tropical biology and the concept of biodiversity as an outcome more connected to Caribbean research than had been previously thought. And I'm really curious as to how you got interested in the subject.
Yeah, well, it is a long and circuitous route, as these things sometimes happen. I guess I'll go way back in that, I was originally trained in my undergraduate studies as a scientist. I went out to Montana. I was going to become a paleontologist. I was interested in field work at that time and evolutionary questions. And I did not expect to become a historian, although looking back, I guess I was always interested in history, in the history of science. I just didn't know that it was a discipline. And so when I took classes in the humanities as an undergraduate student and discovered that history actually included science, that science was a part of society and culture, and that perhaps you could get a job in that field, I decided to, I was seduced by the dark side of the humanities, and I switched over, ended up doing an MA in history there just to be sure that I was really, this was a big change for me, and made that move. So I was interested in field work and in place and in those general questions. And it wasn't just me in the 90s and early 2000s. Historians of science were interested, especially in place and how knowledge is produced in particular places, embedded in the politics of particular sites of knowledge production, and how this local knowledge travels and becomes universal. And in fact, I did an MA project on a totally different time and place, but focused on the similar problems to what I ended up working on in my dissertation, which is the project that this book eventually grew out of. So I actually got into this specific topic much more accidentally. I admit to being a kind of interloper or a blunderer into Caribbean history. I came at it partly because I was frustrated by the U.S. being left out of larger discussions of science and empire, and partly because tropical field stations presented such an interesting and complex problems in these questions about place, politics, knowledge production. And in searching around for a dissertation topic, taking probably far too long to settle on one, I ran across mention of Harvard's field station in Cuba in Stuart McCook's book, States of Nature. And when I did a little more research and found out that it had been actually run by the same person, Thomas Barber, who directed the field station at Barro Colorado Island in Panama in the early 20th century as well, I knew there was a bigger story, a bigger network of sites of science, and I became interested in that and why they hadn't been really looked at closely by historians of science previously. So that, I would say, is the long version or the basic outlines of how I got to it.
I was really glad to read the stuff about the Soledad and the Atkins Cuba station, because that's often sort of studied just on sort of Cuban terms, but it was really interesting to see it put in a much broader context. And that actually brings me to my next question, which is that the book brings together history of science, Caribbean history, and U.S. history. And I'm wondering if you can tell us what kind of intervention you can make by bringing all of those together.
Well, I hope I've done that successfully. I definitely am grounded. It was grounded initially as a historian of science. And basically, I became fascinated by Caribbean history. I feel like Caribbean historians are in a lot of ways much farther ahead of, or were, you know, we're much farther ahead of historians of science in thinking about material and cultural circulations across a heterogeneous kind of region, you know, and, you know, some of the interventions I hope to make by combining these different disciplines is to basically broaden, first of all, the history of science and empire to really fully include U.S. science. It's been for a long time focused, especially on European empires, and not fully really including U.S. science. And when it does, it focused mainly on agriculture and medicine, and not on sciences that have less obvious kind of applications to colonial power, and yet are no less dependent upon and integrated into imperial colonial interests. So that's one of the interventions I tried to make. I suppose the other is that I think that these sites are fascinating places to understand how politics and specific environmental contexts and spaces really shape scientific practices and scientific ideas more broadly. And I can get into that more, but maybe I'll stop there for now.
Sure. Thank you. I think... actually, to get more specific now, you chose to frame it through particular biological stations. So there's the Panama Station, Cuba, Costa Rica, and Guyana comes in as well. How did you choose to write about those particular stations?
Yeah, I chose them because they are basically the stations that focused on basic biology, as defined by the people who work there, and ecological questions during the first half of the 20th century. There were many other types of field stations, agricultural experiment stations, which the Soledad station started off as. There are medical kind of sites, but, you know, and botanical gardens. But there was a specific movement at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, starting in botany in the emerging field of ecology, for field stations to study the relationship between organisms and their environment. And the first stations that U.S. scientists set up to study organisms in their environment as a basic question, an ecological question in the 20th century, were in the at the stations that I study. So the sample size is basically 100%, right? So, or you know, I looked at the stations that existed there. That's I didn't really choose. Maybe it was a foolhardy thing to do because it took me to so many different places. But that's how I chose the sites that I chose, and I do kind of follow through them in as they emerge and sometimes disappear. The few that last to the present are, you know, as biological stations, are really the ones in Panama and Costa Rica.
So the concept of biodiversity is at the center of the book, and one of your aims, I think, is to historicize and demonstrate the roots of biodiversity science and scientific work in the Caribbean. So for those of us who are less scientifically oriented and less well-trained, can you tell us or talk a little bit about how tropicality and biodiversity are related? Because I think that that's one of what's at the heart of your book in some ways.
Yes. Yes. I think that's important. So first of all, you know, a lot of different scholars, scientists, some historians, a lot of philosophers have talked about biodiversity as an idea and as a concern in conservation science. But they usually tend to start with its coining as a term in 1986 and haven't really looked at the deeper history of it, except in broad brush kind of ways. So, you know, you can think about the diversity of life going back to Aristotle. But when after having done a dissertation that really was much more institutional and really went more station by station than the book does, right? And realizing that I needed to, in revising to make the book, have a more through-going narrative and not to lose the institutional side, which is incredibly important, but to do better to weave together the institutional, political, intellectual. You know, I decided to put diversity and the idea of biodiversity at the core. And having written that dissertation, I looked again at the idea of biodiversity and at that National Forum on Biodiversity in 1986, in which the term was first used. And I realized that, you know, most of the organizers were actually tropical biologists and that I could trace their genealogy back to these sites that I had studied previously. So that's what made me focus on biodiversity in the book, where it's sort of just on the edges of the dissertation. It's a long way of getting at your question about tropicality and biodiversity, but I just wanted to explain why or how I ended up making that the center of the narrative. So, you know, as I see it, the connection between biodiversity and tropicality, I think it's important to see the both scientists' discussion of the diversity of life in the tropics as embedded in the broader ideas about the diversity, the fecundity, a kind of the tropics as seen in broader culture, in the studies of ideas of tropicality that come out from cultural historians and geographers, to see scientists' discourses about the tropics as part of that, and at the same time as not just simply subsumed into those broader cultural ideas, but also as being involved in their own kind of sub-discourse that is connected to their professional concerns, their intellectual kind of ambitions throughout the period that I look at, and also embedded in their kind of work in place in which they are not only embedded in their broader cultural ideas that they bring with them as outsiders to the tropics, but also in confronting nature through their field work in these particular sites. Maybe we can talk more about this too, if you have more question about this. I've kind of gone off. Sorry.
No, I was just trying to think through your answer. It gets pretty complicated. So, but I want to talk about the scientists actually also, and the appeal to them in particular about going to the tropics and the ways that, I mean, one of the things that I think you're arguing is that these stations emerged because the state itself thought it was important to have them and scientists thought it was important to have them, but for slightly different reasons and working on slightly different agendas, right? So for the state, it was a sort of question of health and commerce. But for the scientists, it seems like it was something altogether different. So how did that work with the kind of ill-fitting but equally kind of purposeful agendas?
Yes. So the scientists tried different strategies at different times. And that's one of the interesting things about looking at these different sites in the different periods that they emerge. You know, they have their own professional and intellectual concerns that in some cases they're trying to protect under the banner of, say, pure science or basic science, as in the case of the first tropical field station started by Americans that I talk about in the first chapter of the book, the Cinchona Station in the Blue Mountains of Jamaica, which is actually kind of borrowing a British colonial institution, a botanical garden that was already there, and kind of renting it and using it for U.S. science. And they, you know, they did not want to, well, they didn't conceive, first of all, of having it be sponsored by the U.S. government. The U.S. government didn't much fund that sort of science at that time. But they did argue that they needed something that was focused specifically on pure science, that wasn't focused on producing new agricultural commodities, for example. Well, that didn't work all that well for them. They had a hard time getting funding for that. They tried going by subscription and having a lot of different scientific organizations, the New York Botanical Garden, other botanical gardens and museums, kind of chip in and fund this site for U.S. visitors in Jamaica. But it was difficult institutionally to support. And so more successful were the stations that were started in the 20s. Basically, the most important one would be the station at Barrocarrero Island in the Panama Canal Zone at the time. In fact, an island right in the middle of the Panama Canal created by the flooding of the canal. In that case, it was still conceived of as a site for basic science. They weren't going to plant economic an economic botanical garden, for example, there, or do the kind of research that, say, Soledad was initially started for. But they wanted what they conceived of as an untouched remnant of tropical nature there, the rainforest that was on this island. But they did make an argument that understanding the basic ecology and biology of tropical life would be important for the broader goals of the U.S. government, U.S. government agencies, corporations, by understanding the complex relationship between plants, animals, and their environment and in the tropical regions, but also by building up a kind of contingent of biologists who had some tropical experience who could go on to work for the USDA or for the United Fruit Company, right, and have some tropical experience. So they made a variety of different kinds of arguments that that basic research in the tropics could be in the U.S. national interest. And by that means, they managed to get a variety of kind of funding, land, things like that, in order to allow these stations to go on. So it's not they're not working directly for the U.S. government, but they are making an argument that that their expertise could be a potential use, and that this is something that's worth supporting for those broader aims.
So one thing that you make very clear, and it's pretty ironic given all of the sort of quest for knowledge that you just described, is that there were a lot of missed opportunities to include and collaborate with Latin American scientists who presumably knew a lot about the tropics, right? How did that happen? Why was that? And maybe, were there any exceptions at all?
Yes, I mean, there were exceptions. What I'd say is that, first of all, I just want to signpost before getting into the history of this. This is one of the things that came out of this project that I think is especially relevant for the present, and that is one of the reasons why I hope that scientists also read this book, is that the disparities in participation in tropical ecology, tropical biology, still exist today. The sites that continue at Barrocarrero Island, now run by the Smithsonian in Panama, and the Organization for Tropical Studies in Costa Rica, they have a lot of participation by Latin Americans now, but still they retain a lot of character of being U.S. institutions and the legacy of the history that I talk about. So I just want to kind of signpost that for a second. But, the part of the reason why these stations tended to be more like enclaves and tended to exclude Latin American scientists, it partly has to do with their character as stations and their focus on basic research. So as stations, one of the benefits with a lot of drawbacks that you just signposted of a station that was advertised is that this is for visitors from afar. They can come to a place without having to make the local connections that make organizing long distance or in particular tropical travel so difficult and expensive, right? At a tropical station, from a U.S. visitor's perspective, you don't need to hire local laborers. There are local laborers at each of these sites who not only take care of the grounds and cook and clean for a person, but would do take care of experiments, collect animals and plants, and often also had continuous knowledge of the site and could orient foreign visitors to what the animals and plants they were seeing actually were, changes of the seasons, things like this. So because of the kind of labor and physical structure of these sites, that partly fed into the fact that a lot of the visiting researchers had no need to actually get to know the local people in order to be there. And this was actually seen as kind of a benefit, right? You can get right down to work. This has to do partly with their conception of nature as separate from people, and often in conceiving these sites as actually wilderness sites, right? Despite the fact that, say, Barrow, Colorado Island was right in the middle of the Panama Canal and was, in a sense, an artificial island because it was became an island after being a hill when the canal was flooded. So it partly has to do with the institutional labor physical structure of these sites. It partly has to do with the conception that these sites are for getting U.S. scientists in touch with nature, that they're at some distance from Latin American cities where most of the Latin American scientists would be located. That's not to say that there weren't exceptions, as you brought up. And in fact, Thomas Barber, the scientist who directed during the 20s, 30s, and 40s, both the Soledad Station in Cuba and Barrow, Colorado Island in Panama, he spoke Spanish very well. He was very comfortable in the society of Latin American scientists. He worked closely with a lot of different Cuban scientists. But that kind of, and throughout his career, but that didn't necessarily filter down to the much larger numbers of scientists who would visit these sites for a shorter period of time, a few weeks, maybe a month, and who didn't necessarily become integrated into, didn't become acquainted with the society of Latin American scientists who were there. Now, also these different contexts, the Caribbean is so complicated, right? Each country has its own unique scientific community. In Cuba, there is a very well-established community of natural historians. And in that case, there was the possibility for a bit more collaboration. In Panama, it's much less so. The centers of science had been more in Colombia. So it's different in each context. Of course, in the Jamaican case, it's more connected to British colonial science. So each case is very different, which is what fascinated me, but which also made this topic so difficult. I think that covers many of the aspects of what you asked about there.
Yeah, I loved hearing or reading actually about life on the stations. And there are some really wonderful descriptions of it, including and intriguing mentions, and I wish there were more, but I'm sure it was because of lack of sources of the people who were actually collecting the samples and had all this knowledge and doing all of that work. So how much of that was a surprise to you? How much of the descriptions of the sort of scientists trotting in and out and all of that kind of stuff, were you surprised by that at all, or were you kind of expecting that?
Oh, was I expecting there to be local Latin American, Caribbean?
No, mostly just, I'm just wondering about like your descriptions of these kind of scientists showing up for a couple of days and then leaving, and that whole kind of, I don't know, networky kind of scene.
Yeah, that's part of the things that fascinated me about it, because once you talk to scientists who work in these sites now, you realize that they went there because, say, they had an advisor or a colleague who went there, and that person had there's a real genealogy or network, really, of people visiting these sites that goes back to the period of time that I talk about here, up to the present. And yeah, definitely early on, one of the ideas about, you know, ironically, these field stations allowed one of the most important, I think, aspects of knowledge production at these field stations is that they allowed for long-term knowledge. They allowed for understanding changes of seasons in environments that wrongly were assumed to have no seasons. The tropics was assumed to be consistently, you know, without seasons. Well, once you work there for a while, you realize that there's different types of seasons, that there may be no winter, but there's changes in moisture, for example, things like this. So there's that kind of long-term knowledge, also long-term environmental change. Tropics was seen in a general way. If you go back to, say, Alfred Russel Wallace or something like this, there's an idea that the tropics are the most ancient environments in the world, especially tropical rainforests. One idea was that they were so diverse in life. There were so many different various forms of life there because it was undisturbed and had been basically the same. There was no glaciation, so therefore it had just been the same and it was unchanging over time. Well, working at these stations, they saw change. Partly this is because they were working there during periods of time in which there's a massive amount of environmental change due to economic development and things like this. So they're part of the environmental changes that are going on around them. So being in these sites over a long period of time allowed them to eventually, as a group, see the tropics as a much more heterogeneous region, to understand that it's not, you know, can't really be encapsulated by just the rainforest, and that there's change over time at various scales. But that doesn't mean, but ironically, stations also at the same time enable these visitors to come and then go, right? And the people who were really, it began to interest me quite a lot. And I also wish I had been able to research more on this. I think focusing in on one site, and I hope somebody does this, maybe allow you to uncover this more. But the continuity of the workforce at these sites is one way that helped to kind of continue the continuity of knowledge over time. Because it's not the scientists who stayed for years, and you know, it was actually the workers. So there's that. There's this kind of double-edged thing. As a community of scientists, they began to understand this place over a longer period of time. Many of the early visitors did not necessarily stay for a long time, or they might come once a year. Frank Chapman, for example, the ornithologist who was very responsible for writing a lot of popular books about nature at Barrow, Colorado Island, telling stories about the wildlife and creatures there, and actually basically the first person to use camera trapping, flash photography, in which animals kind of capture their own image, that is so kind of popular now and seen to be a recent phenomenon. Actually, he did that in the 20s and 30s. He would come, you know, once a year. You know, you don't necessarily see the full, you know, seasonal span if you do that. You visit only in the dry season, for example. So anyway, there's the nature of these institutions as sites enabling visitors to come for short amounts of time, and yet for a large community of outsiders to have some continuity over time is kind of an interesting, I don't know, double-edged sword about these sites as sites of knowledge production.
I'm curious about the concept of diversity and the way that you demonstrate that it didn't just kind of appear fully formed, but there was a product of debates and discussions. And you track some of those debates, especially in the latter part of the book, about this idea of diversity And so I was wondering how, if you could just talk a little bit about how they played out and how the different contexts and different settings kind of shaped those debates as well.
Yeah, I think one of the things that is key is that there's a major change in the post-World War II period. So in the ways that tropical biologists, as they come to see themselves, think about the diversity of tropical nature and the diversity of life in general. So in the first half of the 20th century, the scientists who I look at largely identify themselves with the naturalist tradition. They are studying organisms and their environment. They are botanists or zoologists. They are thinking about organisms in all their complex relations with each other and with the physical environment. In the second half of the 20th century, after World War II, you start to see different approaches come in. Now, this is partly a broader phenomenon in the history of biology, but it's particularly interesting, I think, in the context of tropical field science. So in this period, you start to see mathematical approaches, you start to see a systems ecology approach, you start to see people trying to generalize about the phenomenon of diversity itself in terms of numbers of species, and not necessarily thinking of diversity, the diversity of life, in terms primarily of the great variety of forms or the relationship between organisms, among organisms, and a diverse environment. So to get specific, you see people like Howard Thomas Odom, like Robert H. MacArthur, trying to generalize about the phenomenon of the number of species and why it seems that there's a global pattern in which there are more species in the tropics. There's a latitudinal biodiversity gradient, as they call it today. So there's a gradient, you know, a physical, natural phenomenon in which there seem to be more species in the tropics than there are, say, in the temperate zone or the Arctic, right? The number of species per area kind of increases in general toward the equator. They're trying to explain patterns of diversity like that. They're also trying to explain broad patterns of diversity like the number of species on islands versus on continents. And this is an intellectual history that has been pretty well trodden by historians of science. And yet what struck me is that even though these scientists all did field work, extensive field work in the tropics and build on the studies of previous tropical field workers who I discussed in the first half of the book, mostly that intellectual history was treated in a completely abstract way. So I think it's actually important to look at the field work they did in its institutional and its political context. These scientists are getting to the sites that they worked at, MacArthur, because there were already U.S. field scientists who had set up field stations, informal field stations in Costa Rica in the 40s and by the 50s when he went there, partly because they could buy land in those sites. So it's the control of land in that case that allows scientists to visit. Howard Odom, he works, for example, not only in Panama when he's in the military during World War II, but also later in the 60s at a very interesting site in what is now known, now acknowledged as El Yunque Forest in Puerto Rico, where he did a radio ecology study. That is, he dosed a part of the rainforest with radiation and then studied the effects. He's only able to do that because he can get funding from the Atomic Energy Commission. He's able to travel to Puerto Rico more easily than to other sites in the tropics. And he's very explicit about this in his discussion for why he chooses the sites he chooses. So these researchers who have been treated their ideas about their ideas for systematizing and mathematizing what we know today as biodiversity, or at that time they discussed as species richness or species diversity, in their attempts to try to understand what could explain the patterns of diversity that they saw geographically in different environments. Their ability to formulate those theories, test those theories, were very much embedded in particular contexts. They couldn't work in the sites they wanted to work on, except for the fact that that they were enabled by essentially U.S. U.S. institutions, U.S. control over land, U.S. power in the Caribbean region. That was a long answer to your question.
I've taken up lots of your time, but it seems that towards the end, I just want to end with one last question. It seems like towards the end of the book, you're headed in the direction of thinking about resonances today. And you talk a little bit about sort of the status of biodiversity as a value and as something to sell or to be traded, you know, among corporations and states. So I wonder if you can, maybe we can end up by talking a little bit about that. How should we take all of these things from your book and allow them to see us better? What's happening today?
Well, I think that is one of my reasons for wanting to connect biodiversity to this deeper history of tropical research is because the valuation of biodiversity that we see today, you know, I think really has its roots in this period of time. It's maybe not a surprise that we see efforts to transform biodiversity into a commodity in order to save it, considering that actually the value of studying tropical life was framed as being in U.S. and corporate interests in the early 20th century. There's a connection there, and it's made quite direct if you follow the institutions and the scientists throughout this period of time. So I think it's important to see that deeper history and not to see these things as a sudden new problem. I also hope that maybe understanding this history can actually open up discussions among these scientists about how to be more inclusive in these sites that have long been so exclusive, and how to open up tropical ecology so that it's no longer, even though it was framed by outsiders, it can maybe be less so going into the future. And that might be a place for some future actual positive movement as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your book, and thanks for talking to me today.
Thank you so much. It's been just a pleasure to talk to you.